I think we'll get started. We have a very aggressive agenda today, and we're going to be discussion on the bioscience stuff that's been ongoing, and I think we had some funding last session to get some of these initiatives going, if that's correct. And so we'll kind of quickly go through a lot of things, but certainly it'll be informational. And then next week we get the bills that that are coming forward in this area. So with that, Mr. Wahlstrom, welcome again. And I think I met your friend there, but when you speak, you can identify yourself. Yes. But welcome, and we'll get started. I know there's a lot going on, so we can get moving. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, we're very grateful to be here and an opportunity to tell you what's been happening with over the last 12 months. We have a lot to cover. Because we're running a little bit late, we're going to try to cut some things short. And I'm asking all the presenters to please keep your comments as brief as you possibly can, myself included. I'll start with the agenda. These are generically, this is what we're going to cover and what we're going to do.
Are we working off of this document, of course, right?
That is correct. We're working off of that document.
Okay, good.
Okay. So on the agenda, this is what we'll cover. It ranges from across the various areas of investment that we're looking at and that we're working on, and I'll put all this in context as we go forward. I want to start out with the summary slide of our funding. You can look at this and you can get a sense of our funding level so far. We started in 2005, and I would like to recognize that the initial funding came primarily from donations, with the exception of $40,000 from the state. In 2005, the funding came from Mayo, the U of M, and Medtronic to get this off the ground. In the second year, we picked up some state funding. The third year, last year, we picked up more. But our goal is to always keep our funding at least never more than 50% is our goal coming from state allocation. As you can see as we go forward, our plan for 2008 requires, and the project you're going to see requires a budget of about $2 million. The light pink represents funds left to close. I might add that when you look at the dark red, this is check in hand. It's in the bank, so to speak. I mean, literally in the bank. The pink is we have many things that we're working on, and over the coming months you'll see that much of the pink turned to red. But I'm not sure we'll make the full $2.2 million that's in our budget for this year.
So you've got about $1.4 million hanging out there that you have to raise or so.
About. Yep. And some of that is coming in some fairly significant grants that you'll hear about one of them later. So any questions on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Walsh. I wonder if you could tell us if you have any sort of background on how this compares to other states in terms of the state funding. I know there's so many different pots of money, but just sort of if you can sort of a general response on how we're doing compared to other states.
Yeah. Well, like you said, Senator Saltzman, there's a lot of different ways to cut this, and maybe we can maybe actually Steve will have some more insights in this, but I can give you a couple numbers. Like I know North Carolina right now is putting about $17 million per year into an organization that has a similar mission to what we have. They have offices around the state. It's a nonprofit, industry-led, trying to generate companies and get things, get things commercialized, so you realize job creation. Ohio has a different amount. It's a different way of looking at it. They have, a large organization. The number that comes to mind for Ohio, I think, is $9 million per year. But then they also have a pool of funds in the area of, I want to say it's around $100 million, but I'm not sure that they can dip into the came out of the private sector to help fund it. There are many different numbers out there, but we are starting. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Wahlstrom.
All right.
Thank you. Continue on.
All right. The moving forward then, There are three initiatives that, just to refresh your memory quickly, there are three initiatives we're working on. Statewide assessment, we finished. It was published in 2006. We're focusing on Destination 2025, which is a 20-year strategic planning process and roadmap developing process. I'm going to let Mr. Steve Dahl, sitting on my left, talk about that in just a minute. Then we are working on the Biobusiness Resource Network, which are several projects that are focused on large issues facing the state or on direct support to companies. One other point I'd like to make is that there's an underlying assumption in everything that we're doing, and that underlying assumption is that we are entering the age of biology, meaning that we've been in the age of information for a long time now. We had the industry age. We always have a lot of these different ages, but we are now entering the age of biology. So our world is changing dramatically because of biology, not just in the areas of bioscience, but all the associated support technologies such as computer technology, et cetera, are all being affected by this movement. But in fact, this movement into biology is being enabled by the information age. And that for once in our lives, we have the ability to deal with the amount of information that is available and must be managed through this biological movement. The next slide, you have a hard copy of this in front of you, as well as what's in your handout. We offer you that hard copy because we'd like you to carry it with you all the time. If you get it laminated, you can use it as a placemat. But what this is intended to do is to make give an image of the bio-life science state or situation in our state. And I'm going to cut this very short in the name of time. But the top box represents industry. It's where jobs are created, companies are created, and most economic wealth is created. That is the world of the private sector. The bottom bottom three boxes represent what we call the community capability. And in the community capability at the very bottom are what we term foundational capabilities. These are things like K-12 education, infrastructure policy, entertainment, so you can attract people, young people especially. All those things fit underneath that, as well as appropriate policy, which, of course, is this world is your world. The green box represents the world of academia. This is the – and in this particular case the world of life sciences, but these enabling knowledge clusters represent the skill sets that a community has to have in order to be able to compete in developing these kinds of industries long term. And much of the money that you placed into the partnership, the Mayo U of M partnership, fits in this area. You'll have a second meeting coming up after this one. It also fits squarely in this area, and I think they'll reference that in their presentation. The large middle box is the area where all the academic world in the green, the private or public sector world in the tan or pink in the bottom, and the private sector all come together. And this is where the area where we need infrastructure and capability to take ideas and knowledge and convert it into jobs and companies. And there are many skills in here. This is not the complete list, but these are the ones for biology that we are focusing on right now. So everything that we do builds off of this slide. There's nothing that's in the projects we'll present to you or anything that does not relate back to this slide. The next image I want to show you relates to a process which we call the Minnesota Life Science Community, and Pam Bishop is going to come up here in a few minutes and talk more about this and our efforts in this area. But in fact, what we recognize is that this area of biology, because this is this is an area of knowledge-based, it's a knowledge-based industry. Because of that, there is no one community in this state, including the metropolitan area, that has everything it needs to be able to take full advantage of this industry. Therefore, we as a state need to work together, collaborate, and share our infrastructure, our knowledge, and our capabilities in order to make it work. And this is a process that we're putting in place to take the previous slide with all the colors on it and distribute it across the state. So whether you're in the Iron Range or you're in the Bemidji or the Southwest, Southeast, it doesn't matter. You would have access to the capabilities you need to start a company or to solve a problem. And we're doing that through a process which is based on the old clustering model, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, which fundamentally, in initial cluster theory, it basically taught communities to try to go out and get everything themselves, as represented by the circle around the on the left side of your chart. What we are advocating for and trying to help establish is what we call hubs and nodes, which is an interconnected community, which can be within the state, but in some cases, which we'll talk about in a minute, some of these capabilities are also outside of the state, and in fact, some of them are outside of the country. And we're trying to connect those capabilities into a hub and node system that all parts of the state can access to try to solve their problems. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. So with that, I'm going to stop. And, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to suggest, because of time, is maybe I'll stop here to ask any if there's any questions. But then we'll hold questions until we get to the end for the rest of the presentation, because this is all set up for me on my part. Are there any, if that's acceptable to you, sir?
I think that's fine. Why don't you continue on?
Any contextual questions anybody might have?
Well, they're just waiting to hear more.
Okay. So with that, then, I'm going to introduce you to Steve Kelly. Steve is will introduce himself, but is our partner with Deloitte, and is they are helping to manage the Destination 2025 and establish a 20-year vision roadmap for the state. So with that, I'll turn to Steve.
Great. Thanks, Dale. And,
Mr. Dahl, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Steve Dahl. I'm a director with Deloitte Consulting here in Minneapolis. I run our public sector practice here in the state and across the region. Just by way of context, we have about 900 people in Minneapolis, about 30,000 around the country, and about 150,000 around the world. We've been working with the state for over 20 years, so we've been around working in the public and private sector for quite a long time. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk with you a little bit about Destination 2025. We started collaborating with BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota in January of this year, so started a couple of months ago, and I'm very proud to be associated with this initiative and also with really what you're doing. This is, I think, a great example of where state government is looking at a long-range plan and view of what can be done to develop capabilities, develop people, and develop businesses looking out in the future. And that's a terrific thing. So I'm very happy to be part of it. I'd like to give you a quick snapshot of Destination 2025 and what that entails. It really entails development of six industry white papers around the core industries that BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota has in its charter to look at. Those are, as you see on the screen, medical devices, pharma, biologics, animal health, food, renewable energy, and biomaterials. Now, those papers have as their focus really looking at a few things. One is looking at what do these industries look like, short run and over the long run, what direction are they headed, what are some of the technologies and discoveries that are going to shaping their direction right now and are expected to shape them going forward. Some of the constraints that are out there and risks and uncertainty around Minnesota's position in those marketplaces and things that can be done to shore those up as well as take advantage of the spot where Minnesota is particularly well-positioned. What are some of the collaborative opportunities that exist and should be leveraged further, or those that don't exist and really should begin? And then lastly, what are the what's the status of talent in Minnesota and talent development, and what do we want to do about that going forward? Those white papers then provide a variety of viewpoints that are kind of brought together, and I'll talk in a second about how that's developed. And at the end of the day, at the end of the process, they fold into a roadmap, which is our Destination 2025 roadmap, which provides policy recommendations for academia, government, and industry to act on. The timeline for this is to have some of these project deliverables, the white papers and other pieces, available for distribution and beginning of broader discussion in fall of 2008 through the summer of 2009. So how do we get there? that's what we have in our focus to do. And how we get there is really at its core, a five-step process that we've laid out. The first step is to draft these white papers, and we get thought leaders from within the industries to draft those white papers and work then with the Core Governance Board and group at BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota to get that initial straw model. Once the draft is out there, then we expand the look for further review as an input, and that's with further thought leaders, and I'll give you some examples of who some of those people are, both in Minnesota and nationally, in industry and academia and government, as well as a panel of experts from Deloitte that we reach into our organization nationally and globally to provide. The third step is once we have those pulled together, we take a very broad look at input and analysis by conducting a number of surveys of different businesses and leaders that are involved and impacted by this process, and pull all that research and input together. And finally, in step four, with now we have a white paper that kind of pulls together these thoughts and recommendations into one spot. And then step five, again, this is then ultimately rolled up into a end product and roadmap with the recommendations that I described. So who does this? Who's doing this work? I think you're familiar with, obviously, Mr. Wahlstrom and the BioBusiness Alliance core team and governance group from Deloitte, myself, and then we also have, I'll introduce here in the audience, Casey Healy, who's a director, Deloitte Consulting, if you can stand up, who also leads our alternative energy initiative. He's out of Chicago. And then Rehan Malik, who's our project manager, also out of Minneapolis. When it comes to the examples of the network that we're reaching into and the panel of experts that will be part of pulling this together, from Deloitte, you can see an example here from BioPharma. And I think the key takeaway I'd like to suggest on these slides is really getting a feel for kind of the breadth and depth of what's being provided into the process. You'll see national and global leaders in the thought leaders in this area that are inputting into the process, very similarly to renewable energy. When you look at across the academic and industry participants, again, I'll give you kind of a flavor, a feel for people that are already involved in this process, and you'll see a list of people from, again, from academia, from government, and from private sector, both from people that are here in Minnesota as well as recognized people nationwide. So this is the list for food, and then also a similar list for renewable materials, again, to give you a flavor or feel for the types of core input participants and panel members that are part of each one of those six different areas as we move forward. So that's a quick snapshot on Destination 2025. What it entails, where we are in the process, we're in that kind of step one and step two part in the process of the drafting and initial reviews around those papers. So we're excited about where things are and where they're headed. And at this point, I'll turn it back to Dale.
Okay, thank you. If I could, Senator Sparks, maybe we'll hold questions because we're running behind schedule, unless there's a real burning question you want to ask right now.
I think we're okay, Mr. Wahlstrom.
Sorry?
I think we're okay, Mr. Wahlstrom.
Okay. All right. Then what we're going to do next.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl.
The next step in our process, I like, is moving more into the business resource network. And what we're trying to do to take this capability that we have and spread it across the state, and starting, first of all, with identifying what capability we really have. Because what we have found, and I'll speak for myself personally, but it was having been in industry for 30-some years and just recently entered this world, I have been absolutely amazed as I traveled around the state to find out what's here. I did not know that until I started looking. So our first step is to figure out what resources do we have, get them organized in a way that we can get access to them and we can leverage them in other parts of the state. So to present that, I'm going to introduce Pam Bishop, who can give a background herself, but from the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, who we're partnering with to do that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Bishop.
Thank you, Senator Sparks and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's a great pleasure. The Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation is happy to play a role in helping to ignite and to create the Biobusiness Resource Network approach to how we begin driving what is so important to building business, and that's creating a network, a system, in which we can create opportunities to build the infrastructure and to provide technical expertise across the state to help startup companies, as well as companies that want to expand here, and to also help companies decide to make their home here in the state of Minnesota. Today, I'd like to share with you three key components to this work. Number one, the partnership that's been created, how we would plan to implement the Biobusiness Resource Network throughout the state, and as a result of that, what will we see that will be different because of our work here. Briefly, I'd just like to share with you our mission. Our mission involves a lot of things at the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, but we are especially interested in creating support and convening opportunities related to biomedical, bioagriculture, and renewable energy. We have funding resources to do that, but more importantly, we believe it's the partnerships related to these areas that will make a key difference in how we can contribute our knowledge and expertise in the southeastern tier of the state. We do represent 20 counties. We've been around for about 21 years, and we're one of five other initiative foundations in the state created by the McKnight Foundation. Because we do have great work in this area, we do have the connections and the contacts, and we have what we believe the networks to support the Biobusiness Alliance's work in this area, particularly when it comes to building these systems that will be so important to the implementation of the Biobusiness Resource Network. Key to igniting this project, I firmly believe, was a conversation that took place about a year ago with the McKnight Foundation. Between the Alliance and the Foundation, we sat down with some key members of McKnight and talked about how can we move biobusiness ahead in the state with the resources and tools and the capabilities that we have as two organizations. We were encouraged by McKnight to submit an application to frame our work about the strategy behind building and implementing the Biobusiness Resource Network. In November, we were awarded the full amount of $500,000 to get this project off the ground over the next 3 years. And again, this is really to develop and grow biobusinesses related to companies in greater Minnesota. The intent is to build the capabilities and the infrastructure to support the kinds of things that startup companies need in the state, and to figure out how we help grow those companies that are already here, and then how do we recruit companies that perhaps have would consider Minnesota a place to do business. As a result of that initial grant, the Mayo Clinic has stepped up to the plate, and they have provided the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation another $100,000 to be used towards biobusiness initiatives, half of which has been targeted to support the Biobusiness Resource Network. We also are excited about the interest that we're receiving from economic developers across the state to get involved, community leaders who also share the same vision for the process. And we also have been fortunate in receiving a student from the University of Minnesota who is helping us with the inner workings of developing that system and collecting the data that will be so important to the process. And how will we gather this information? The Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation has been fortunate and has years of experience in asset mapping. And we've done this through an organized fashion created by John McKnight from Northwestern University. And we believe that communities that focus on their assets have the best chance for success because they can realistically leverage those resources based on what they do have, not based on what they don't have. And so as part of this work, we'll be talking with communities on a high-level inventory level, which we'll start doing now. And then we'll start doing some real in-depth asset mapping, bringing key stakeholders to the table to talk about what do you have in your community, what capabilities do you have in terms of technical expertise, what kind of infrastructure do you have, and what kind of knowledge do you have. And this will be so important because as a result of this work, we can start talking with each other as communities and as leaders of the state. We can start leveraging those resources so that we can share what we have with the companies that need it most related to bio-based initiatives. That could be technology, that could be suppliers, that could be bioscience itself. But it's important that we understand what we do have so that we can have those kinds of conversations with real companies wanting to grow here. It will also be important as we do our work in San Diego at the Bio Show in June. So that's why these conversations are already starting in the state, so that we can test this knowledge out, and we can truly find out how much of a difference it will make in having those real kind of conversations based on the assets that we're going to be pulling out of communities and putting into a systematic database that can be part of these regional centers that will, again, network ourselves as an entire state. So we're working regionally, and we're working as a state as a whole. So at the end of the day, what will result? Well, as mentioned earlier, we hope that we'll be aligning our partnerships, and we hope that business development will occur more rapidly and more effectively, because we will have this technical expertise in-house and in a database, and we'll be aware of that information at a much higher level. We'll also have the infrastructure in place because of the system that we will be creating. People will have access to this information, and we'll be able to lead people to this information to support the growth of a business. And then it will be sustainable. I mean, that is key to how we do our work. We need a tool that will allow us to sustain this effort over a long-term period that can be evolved over time and can also be added to as we continue to grow bioscience types of businesses in the state of Minnesota. We also hope it will help us to evaluate more businesses per region, per year, and also to support commercialization of more businesses per region, per year. So that's significant, and in turn, hopefully that will create more jobs as a result. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair? I'd like to make one interconnecting point here with the work that we're doing with the partnership with PAM and the Initiative Foundations is helping us to define what we have. The work that we're doing with Deloitte is to find out what do we need to have as we look forward, so we can do an analysis to understand the difference between the two, so we can help to give insights in the kinds of investments and the kinds of things we need to look at as we prepare for the future. Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to shift gears a little bit now and talk. By the way, I want to be clear. We do not have time to cover everything, so we're just getting a few highlights. And one of the highlights we wanted to make sure we talked about was two projects we have going. One is called IBSC, and I'll ask Mr. Richard Lemmers to join me, and we'll talk about another one called IREDI. The first one, the IBSC, the International Business Support Center, if you refer to this graph, you'll notice a yellow arrow. On the middle column, when we were looking at at the areas of weakness that we know we have in the state, in the area of biologics and biopharma type commercialization, our commercial sector in that top red box, in the top red triangle rather, is weak. We said, all right, let's take a look at what can we do to try to attract companies to try to build that up. And as we looked around, we thought one of the logical candidates to look at is the international community. So we kicked off this International Business Support Center. This is the mission and the vision. I'm not going to go through that now. But the net is this, that we looked around the world and said, what communities are the communities that have what we have? Sorry, they have what we don't have. And what communities need what we have? Then we started reaching out to them to establish relationships. There's four countries we're working with right now are Sweden, Japan, Scotland, and Canada. We have signed a memorandum of understanding with Sweden that we will be a preferred landing strip from some of their biotech companies as they try to enter the U.S. market, and they've agreed to provide the same support to our companies that want to go to the European market. We're in final stages of negotiation or discussions with Japan in the Osaka region, Osaka and Kobe, and to do the same thing. We just signed this first agreement last August. We have our first company coming now out of Stockholm. It's a biotech company. It's market release. It's small. I think they have 30 employees right now, but they're growing rapidly. They have agreed, or they've done their due diligence and are going to make their U.S. home in Minnesota, and their The tech transfer person will be here, will move here for a one-year assignment in the end of March, and they will be here to start site selection this summer. We have two more Swedish companies that are coming over in the next 2 months to start to go through the same process, and we're going to Japan in May to sign the agreement with the Osaka-Kobe region. With that, I'll let it go, except to say that I think we've uncovered a niche here that's that there's a lot of interest in, and it's we're excited about it. So with that, and again, I'm trying to catch up on our schedule a little bit. I'm gonna now turn it over to Mr. Richard Lemons, who can introduce himself and talk about another strategic initiative that's targeted specifically at trying to get companies and capability into the state.
Mr. Lemons, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Richard Lemons. I'm a consultant in the area of project leadership, and I work with the company Project Leadership Services. We'll try to keep this moving briskly along. U.S. Ambassador to Sweden Michael Woods observed that there were a number of companies in Sweden that had advanced technologies further advanced than those in the United States in the area of renewable energy. He launched what he called the One Big Thing initiative, which was aimed at trying to make that technology available in the United States with an idea that it would have multiple benefits to us. The work that he launched was picked up by a committee that put together a request for proposal that went out to many states. Out of the many states that were given the opportunity to put in proposals, six of those were deemed worthy of moving forward, and three of them, including Minnesota, New York, and Georgia, are now finalists in the selection process. That's been a lot of work that's taken place with representatives from the Minnesota State Colleges and University System, Minnesota State University Mankato, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Biobusiness Alliance, and private sector companies as well. The strategy that we put forward in our proposal was that we would form two entities, one for-profit, one not-for-profit. The for-profit entity is really focused on commercialization, finding partners in the state of Minnesota that could pick up the technology that's now available in Sweden and either manufacture or distribute those products here. There's a strong interest on the part of the Swedish companies to find partners who really want to make product here, which would obviously result in the creation of jobs and conceivably new companies in the state of Minnesota. The Not-for-Profit Institute is really about applied research. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to test and certify equipment coming into the marketplace and likely adaptation required for that equipment. Minnesota State University Mankato is that institute, and that is the part that is technically called IREDI. Presently in Sweden, there are 23 companies that have signed letters of intent to work in this concept. They have technologies that span a broad range of areas from biomass burning to wind to wave to a lot of different renewable energy technologies. We chose the Minsky system, and specifically, next slide, please, Dale, system because of the scale of the system, and specifically Minnesota State University as the host because of its focus in partnering with industry. There's a center of excellence there focused on manufacturing that really is a very good fit for this, and it provides existing resources both in terms of physical and human resources. Bottom line for Minnesota is this is an opportunity to create jobs in an area that also provides a benefit to the environment, both in the form of expansion of existing companies and new companies. Just a quick comment on what this has done for Sweden. Sweden has been able to reduce its carbon footprint by 7% while concurrently growing its economy by 39%. Clearly a reduction on dependence on petroleum-based energy, and the benefit is economic growth as well. Our ambassador had identified 39 companies, actually, that were accountable for having developed those technologies to create those percentages. Just a quick status report. The selection process is underway. The selection committee visited all three states in the last week. On Monday of this week, we entertained the group of people here in the state of Minnesota. We took them on a tour of Minnesota State University Mankato and then brought them into the Twin Cities for a tour of the University of Minnesota, specifically the IRE operation, which is actually linked with our proposal with Minnesota State University. With that, I'll take any questions if you have them.
Okay, I think we'll hold on the questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard. Okay, one point I might add that's of interest maybe, the data we got from Sweden just tonight for last was that they're currently 42% of their energy is now renewable. So they really moved up the ladder quickly. And the other thing is that part of why we, another reason we picked a Minsky system is that they have such far-reaching capability for application. We have, they would be the intent that they would be, Mankato will be reaching out across other sectors to gain, or other institutions to get access to the capabilities they have. Okay, we have approximately 1.5 hour left, and we have two speakers left, and but I think we're shifting gears now. So I think what I'm going to do is, if it's okay with you, Mr. Speaker, or is if we could open it up to questions, because we're now going to shift gears into modeling, and it's a different topic. So maybe in any of these previous initiatives, we could, if there are any questions anybody has, we could take those now.
Okay. That know this yet. That's the group. This is.
I don't. Guess we're okay, Mr. Wallstrom.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Sparks. Mm-hmm. All right. One of the things that we were specifically asked to spend a little bit of time on is the area of modeling, because one of the larger investments that we're making is to develop the capability to do modeling on in the area of renewable energy. At the end of the process, we will have the capability to model bioscience industry, period. But to start with, we're focusing on renewable energy. I'm going to ask Greg Mast to join me up here now and get ready to demonstrate that. But in the process, I want to give you a little bit of background. The model that we have is have developed is a model that takes into account the five different sectors of renewable fuels, or renewable energy rather, electricity, transportation, industrial, commercial, and residential. These are the federal categories where they're broken out in federal data. We've developed also measures. So as you look at various inputs to this model, you will have measures coming out. The team that was put together to assemble this capability is from across the state. They worked for several months to pull the information necessary to compile a model capable of being predictive. This model that we have is a model that's based on a technology called system dynamic modeling. System dynamic modeling is a tool that is used to allow you to take a look at the complete system and integrate various subsystems of that system together, so that when you make a decision, the model will tell you or give you a sense of how one decision is affecting another part of that subsystem. So as an example, how would an incentive affect job creation? How would an incentive affect the ability to produce? How would a change, a technological breakthrough in, say, productivity of corn growth, how will that affect the ability to provide increased outputs? So why we elected to do this is because the whole issue of renewable energy, in fact, biosciences in general, is all heavily integrated. And there is no human being I know, and I would submit there is no human being alive, that has the intellectual power to be able to keep track of all the interactions that a decision can have when it is made and implemented over time. So not to make the claim that a model can do that either, but a model helps you to track those inputs so that you can get an indication of the impact. And we'll show you that in a minute. We started this process working with the Sandia National Lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico, or in New Mexico. We partnered with a company out in California called Forio to build a user-friendly interface, which unfortunately we cannot show you. except in screen slides, because you need a high-speed internet connection to be able to do that. So in this venue, what we'll do is Greg will show you a sample of what the model does using the tool that the actual modeler would use to develop the model. And then we'll show you some slides after that of what that would look like in the user-friendly interface. So with that, I'm going to just walk through a couple of background slides to kind of give you a sense, and then I'll turn it over to Greg. In this particular slide, this is a projection of national transportation fuel consumption, and I might add that the reason we're showing this to you is that, and Greg will show you some actual slides on this, but what this is based on is data. Instead of taking opinion, models are based on data because they don't run well on opinion. They need actual concrete numbers, and those numbers have to come from research and literature, and that's what goes into building a model. So this data is a sample, I'm going to show you four slides. They're samples of kind of data that's in there, and Greg will show you a little bit more. But this shows you, in general, data coming from the federal government, where they're projecting a 1.06% annual projected growth rate in transportation fuel consumption. Based on that, and you can see that out to 2030, there is a reduction in the growth rate of petroleum-based consumption, but not a negative trend. The same is true with Minnesota, although our renewables look much better. We have a much greater impact because of what we do here and our capabilities that we have. We still do not even reverse the trend in the state of Minnesota. This is a projection of national electricity production showing you where it's coming from. And as you can see, this slide happens to go out through 2025. But through 2025, you can see that fossil fuels continue to be the lion's share. And there's some dent on the top with total renewables, but not a tremendous amount. In Minnesota, it's different. And that if you look at the bottom, renewables, and this slide is on the bottom, we have a lot more, primarily driven by, of course, by wind in the area of renewable. But as you can see, even here, we don't have a tremendous reduction in our consumption of other sources of energy as well. A couple more slides, and then I'll turn it over to Greg. These are our setup slides. The fundamental underpinnings of the procedure or the process that we put in place is scenario planning. Because as you go forward and you try to do policy and create policy, you need to look at different scenarios in order to be able to determine what one scenario will have an impact on a specific decision. So, again, Greg will show you that. But the point I want to make on this slide is that all decisions are made on models. Whether it's your own mental model, your own opinion about what it is, you have a mental model. And that model may be filled with erroneous information or it may be right on. You don't know. So what you try to do with this is take all the mental models from the various constituents that are involved, and you have to invite everybody in that process. You need to have the environmentalists, the producers, the growers, all the folks who, the consumers, all the folks who are part of that system need to be involved in developing the model. And only by doing that, then, can you integrate all these various mental models into one that's a shared model. It helps increase the probability of making the right decision. It does not mean you will make the right one, but it helps you to increase that probability. Every time you run a scenario, every time you run a model, you always have to ask these three questions. First question is the model output true? And if it is it showing us something that is unintended or expected? We have some that were unintended, which we'll share with you. The second question you have to ask is, are the results skewed because the data is incorrect? I can guarantee you that there are many of the model outputs that come out of this where the data is incorrect. And it's because the data doesn't always exist. Or the information you see in any one specific case maybe one extreme perspective. So we have data, and it's through the utilization of a team of experts that we're able to come in and take that information and come out with a more probable, what we call base case scenario. And the third one is, ask the question, is the model result skewed because the model structure is incorrect? For the last 3 months, We have been what we call validating the model, and we've been looking at different aspects of it, and we're pretty comfortable at this point that we've caught we've caught the big issues, or we'll still find small ones as we go forward. You always do. But we're at the point now where it's ready to jump in the water, so to speak, and swim with it. So that's what we're doing. One other point I want to make before I turn over to Greg is that the model is in the form, or the way we've built this model is an unconstrained condition. This is an important point. Because it's an unconstrained condition. What it basically says is we will have all the money we need to build all the windmills or the wind generators we will have all the workforce necessary to fill every job that comes along. We'll have all the research problems will be solved, so therefore fundamental knowledge will not stand in the way. And as you all know, that is not real. That's not reality. But that's where you start. You start and you say, what if we have that? Then what? And then you start to build down from that, and we'll show you how that process works. I'm not going to go through these except to give you one example of how the team works. These are all the next two slides are all the inputs that are basic coming or base going into the model, and they are driven by that team of experts. An example of how the process works is an area of corn yield. When we settled on 2% as the corn yield rate improvement per year, that was a highly debated topic. We had one constituent in the room that said, oh, you're crazy, it's 4%. It's going to be 4% growth increase per year. We had another one that said, no, you're crazy, it's going to be 1 or less per year. And through the course of about an hour-long dialogue, we settled on what could be real, what could really happen with a high degree of probability is 2%. So by going through each one of these dialogues with the different experts, we came to a point to say, these are reasonable. This is something that could really happen. And all sides of the table would accept that. So that's what's in the model. That's what's driving the base case that Greg's going to talk to you about. The only one I'd add is the wind targets are based on the RPS, the legislated numbers. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg.
Mr. Mast, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Greg Mast. I'm Senior Program Manager at the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. And today I'd like to take you through a view of the renewable energy model that we've put together. And my approach will be to take a very technical issue and explain it in a very non-technical fashion. So how I will do that we'll approach this from a bottom-up perspective. And so I'll show you and describe to you where the data lies, the approach to how we collected the data. And then the next step will be within the development version of the commercial software application, which the development team created the model. I'll show you just some insight into how system dynamics works and just a graphical representation of certain views, which help understand how the model will function. And then after that, we'll then run through one base case scenario, which you'll see in a slide that is much more prettied up, that the user interface, which is more friendly and intuitive to most end users, will also present the same graphical representation. But because we do not have the capability to connect at high speed, we'll just focus most of our time within the development side of the model, and we can field some questions after that. So I'd just like to start with showing the data store right now. The team has collected data among various types of the renewable energy sectors and created and pulled data from national databases, from national experts, regional experts. And we're currently storing this data that drives and runs the model in Excel workbooks and various other data stores. But I wanted to just show you some examples of how there are some internal calculations within our data store and where some of these sources are that are highlighted through National Department of Energy and also Minnesota Department of Commerce numbers, just to give you a feel for how some of this data was arrived at. I won't spend too much time on showing you where the data is stored and how it's stored, but rather we'll jump right into the version of the model which is created and developed in Ventsim, which is the software application. And for development purposes, we've created, even developers need a simple user interface to navigate to where they're doing their work. And so this has been created by the internal team here, which basically lays out the various areas and sectors which the renewable energy model will run scenarios. And you can run scenarios based on levels of investment or different types of policy decisions and understand the effects of those decisions in a simulated fashion. So just to walk you through what some of these models and the system dynamics way of thinking and the approach that we take, I'll drill into the fraction of renewables. So the way that the development takes place is in system dynamics, it's not necessarily a linear relationship from variable to variable. It's a system's way of thinking. And so as we look to determine what is the total fraction of renewable energy that we're consuming here in Minnesota, we have to take a look at the areas of renewable residential fuels, renewable electricity consumption, renewable commercial fuel, renewable transportation fuel, and renewable industrial fuel. And through this, we then, I'll just drill in here so you can see some of these mathematical equations that take place will aggregate all of these various areas. And so through the model, what the developer will then see is the actual output of the fraction of total Minnesota usage. And we're running this off of the base case, which currently exists in this version of the model. So as we can see, using the assumptions that drove the base case in this from the experts, and what we're seeing here is a fraction of renewable usage, just a bit over 20%. And I think we're all well aware of the 25 by 25 standard that we're hoping to achieve. And this is really the part of the goal of the model is to help us determine which scenarios and which levers do we have at our utilization, and also to extend to the various stakeholder groups ways of having the dialogue to approach and really have the conversation around some of the gaps that we've identified. And so just to take that one step further, one area where perhaps there's an unintended consequence that we've seen through the model, and this presents the opportunity to start having those conversations, is when we look at the area of, let's say, wind power. And so here, from the base case, which I've shown you, I'm going to make the assumption and play the scenario that we've increased the amount of electricity that we're going to derive from wind energy to 30% by 2025 rather than 25%. And so as we add this to our scenario, we'll go to the wind section view, which again, there's many different views, but ultimately the development group, this is how we arrive. This bottom right corner here is actually where's the output at. And so when we run this, we can see that the total trillion BTUs by the ability to incrementally increase our amount of wind energy by 5%, we can see through a numeric representation, by 2025, that's a difference of nearly 30 trillion BTU. So this allows us to play with these different scenarios, levering up and down different sectors of renewable energy, again, in a systems way of thinking. However, as we came across this, what Mr. Walserman referred to earlier, when we look at the area of job creation, and what I'm going to do is add the assumption that we now in Minnesota determined that we would like to add to the renewable energy portfolio solar. So I'm going to add a scenario that plays out from the base case saying that by 2025, 15% of our renewable portfolio will be derived from solar power.
Which, by the way, is not real.
And this is the beauty of the simulation. So what I'll do is I've added that to my scenario. And we're going to look in the area of electricity jobs. Very quickly, total renewable jobs from electricity. We can see that as we've started to make that increase in production from those various sectors, we need to construct the solar capacity along with the wind capacity. And my base case is the green line, as you can see on the bottom. And again, that's taking in all of the what we know today and the arrived at consensus of what is possible, knowing what we know. But our two scenarios, levering up wind power and then introducing solar, we can see that the renewable electricity jobs, it looks favorable. However, as we then drill just a bit further, and we start to look at what is the net effect on total electricity jobs. And here, perhaps, there's an unintended consequence. And I'll try and blow this up just a bit more. So again, base case is the green line.
They're all construction jobs.
Our increase in wind, again, is the blue line, and our solar is the red line. And this is the net electricity jobs that we're seeing. And as we would expect, we see a spike due to construction for both of these different sectors. But over time, what we're beginning to see is the number of jobs, net jobs, created or lost in the electricity sector actually seems to be more favorable if we were to introduce solar. And the underlying reason for that is, overall, the initial construction jobs, but then the key is operations and maintenance jobs, from national data, once again, show that it is more heavily intensive and more operations and maintenance jobs are needed in the areas of solar than from wind. So perhaps this is an unintended consequence, and I'll let Mr. Wallstrom expand.
Yeah, one other comment on this, you'll notice that it goes negative. So when you look at it, this when we saw this initially, we said, okay, the model's broken. Something's wrong, it's not working, so we started digging in to try to understand why. And in fact, there probably is, for the state of Minnesota, there probably is a data error in a sense that the literature, the only literature that's out there is national literature. So it's based on a national number and a national ability to predict job growth. Well, many other parts of the country are more dependent on the petroleum-based industry or the fossil fuel-based industry than we are. So we now know that this graph of job growth in the state of Minnesota is probably incorrect. But this is something that we would have to go after. A national, federal-level person would be interested in this graph. So we need to just think about it. It's not a solution. We also need to, we go in and we now relook at this data, which, by the way, there's a team in Minnesota that has taken on looking at that right now, because that's the next step, is to understand what's really going on. We might find that, in fact, we will find, I'm sure, that for the state of Minnesota, that graph is incorrect. But for the nation, it's a consideration to think about.
And so, again, we're just running, we have the ability to run scenarios like this, whether we think they seem reasonable or unreasonable, but we can see the impact and where those conversations need to be, and we can engage those groups and stakeholders that need to be at the table to understand the issues. And what I would like to do, I could run various scenarios for you and continue to do this all afternoon, but for the sake of time, I think what we'll do is transition back, and we'll show you a snapshot, a few slides within the deck that ultimately – you saw the development version and the peek into the development side.
Is this his day job?
The actual user interface, this is where an end user would, and this is how we'll socialize this with different communities. And this is the user interface. And you can see how the output is much more clean. And this is where we can try and better understand the outputs and the team at the Alliance can go and have those conversations.
Yeah, I might add, just to be clear, that the reason we didn't show it to you in this format is because we don't have an internet connection in this room, and you need an internet connection. That's why we're showing you slides instead. But this is an interesting slide. Maybe we can back up.
Sure.
This is an interesting slide. According to the data that we have, again, from an expert group, we will need, in order to make our 25 by 25, or to make base case, we'll need somewhere between 5,700 and 6,400 wind turbines. Right now we have a little over 1,000. So there's a lot of growth opportunity there. The question comes, can we do it? Same is true with jobs. You look at this is transportation jobs. When you see it all combined, I want to repeat, unconstrained model. We're saying we'll have enough kids around, we'll have enough people around who want to be trained to do this. We also know that's not real. So we have to focus on methods to improve efficiency. We have to focus on ways to make sure the academic curriculum is ready to support them. And in this particular case, there's a team of folks who have led by Gail Kane from the Minsky organization, that is now looking at taking and building out this level of the model further so they can start to look at what jobs in what time frame so that you can understand the nature of the position, not just what the literature has today, which is total jobs. So you have to get very specific in order to make the right policy decision. So this is we have one more presentation to make, but in closing, we'll just say this, that we are it's out there now. We are using it for Destination 2025. We have used it with a couple of a community and another topical group, and we're starting to take it out into the across the state to use it. So anybody in the room where if they'd like to have a session, we'd be happy to facilitate that. So I think what we're going to do now is ask Greg to exchange places. We have one more presentation, a short one, and then we'll open up for 5 minutes of questions if we can. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. So the last one, when we talked about when we committed to you and to the Bioscience Committee last year when you gave us the money, one of the conditions was that we would develop a local capability to do this, because in order to do this kind of modeling today, we have to go to the East Coast, West Coast, or one of the national labs. And we worked with Sandia National Lab and a company from California to develop this so far. But I'd like to ask the presenters to come forward, and it's Amari Munson and Steve Kelly, to talk about our efforts to put a local capability in place to do this kind of modeling in Minnesota. So with that, oh, you're here. Good.
Senator Kelly, welcome back. Nice timing.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You've all had the experience of having to go speak to a Rotary Club about what you're up to, and I was doing that in the break between the House hearing and today. But thank you very much for your attention to this issue. I'm Steve Kelly. I'm a senior fellow at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, and I'm also the director of the university's Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy. And the center is in a collaboration with the BioBusiness Alliance on the systems dynamic modeling capability. We have a faculty member, Professor Jennifer Kuzma, who's been paying attention to developing this capacity and is also on the board of the BioBusiness Alliance. So we've been working very closely together. The center's mission is to improve people's lives by improving the application of science and technology to solving public problems. And we think systems dynamic modeling is one of those techniques or technologies that can help improve public policy. But I recognize that I didn't know enough about this. So I brought with me somebody who has some hands-on experience. So I want to introduce Mari Munson, who's a second-year student in the Masters of Science program in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy. Ms. Munson has been working with Professor Kuzma and with the BioBusiness Alliance, and she can tell you a little bit about her experience.
Great. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mari Munson, and I've been working with the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota on developing the renewable energy strategic model. So I've had kind of an inside look at how this system dynamics modeling can be used for public policy decisions. I'm also working with the BioBusiness Alliance and the Humphrey Institute on the Modeling Center, Building Local Capacity. So I want to tell you briefly why I think, from a student perspective, it's important to develop this kind of local capacity. Again, I think it's system dynamics modeling is a useful tool for looking at issues within the systemic structure and kind of looking ahead to see what unintended consequences might make up so that we can make better policy decisions from the beginning. I think students in a variety of fields and disciplines would be interested in having access to this kind of tool, whether they're going forward in the public sector or the private sector or nonprofit. The interaction of all of those sectors, I think, could benefit from this type of tool. I'm personally using system dynamics modeling to do my senior master's thesis, which is a policy analysis of biofuels policy, looking at renewable fuel standard versus a low carbon fuel standard, specifically with regard to CO2 emissions in the state of Minnesota from the transportation sector. So I'd also like to just share with you some of the things we've accomplished so far with this modeling initiative. We've conducted a number of interest group meetings. Some of the current topics that we've looked at in system dynamics, at our last meeting we had Steve Taff, who's from the Applied Economics Department at the University of Minnesota, present on his real-life use of system dynamics modeling in concert with the Great Plains Institute to look at CO2 emissions from the electricity sector. And specifically, he's used this tool with stakeholders to show people, here's some of the impacts that different policy changes would have on electricity price, on the portion of electricity from renewables, and on CO2 emissions in the state. I wanted to show you this slide so that you can see the variety of interest that we've had. This is a representation of the various people that have attended our initial two interest group meetings. So you can see there's a wide range of departments at the U of M. There's some government representatives, nonprofit, and private sector people. So again, I think you can see that there is a wide range of interest in pursuing local capacity in a modeling tool like system dynamics. And finally, looking ahead to what we have planned with our initiative, I thought it might be of particular interest to you to know that we're pursuing a one-day workshop in June of this year that's geared specifically towards legislative staffers. And the idea would be that we would provide some basic background context in system dynamics modeling and then also hopefully give some hands-on experience within the modeling tools. And with that, I'll thank you and pass it back over to Steve Kelly. Okay,
thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, Ms. Munson made a couple points that from my experience I think are important about this and why I think pursuing this does make sense. And that is, I think over time, service in the legislature reminds you that things don't often work in a linear way, you know, where you touch one thing and you get the expected result. And what really happens is that there are feedback loops and a variety of components of this system. And if you try to understand how the system interacts with its components ahead of time, you can figure out where to intervene more effectively and avoid some of the unintended consequences. It was a cliche around when I was in the legislature to talk about the law of unintended consequences. I don't think there's a law. I think there's a degree to which the legislature with its staff and the people who provide advice are able to think ahead about some of the feedback loops and how they might give us unintended consequences. And these systems apply to natural systems, you know, like the environment, but also to human systems. And that's why I think there's this interesting interaction between science and policy in this area. We're committed. The third thing that I like about system dynamic modeling is that oftentimes, particularly as I learn about things at the university, we tend to get focused on what expert knowledge is about these things. But if you're really going to understand a system that affects people, oftentimes it's folks on the street or in their communities who have an appreciation for a component of the system that an expert might not otherwise spot. So if you're really going to describe the system accurately, the systems dynamic modeling is a way of bringing experts and citizens together to better understand the forces that might affect a public policy decision. So we're committed to pursuing this as a center and at the Humphrey Institute. We've been supporting, along with the BioBusiness Alliance, these workshops and other ideas for starting to spread understanding about this. We're committed to raising money for a visiting faculty member who would be at the university at the Humphrey Institute and could start help us move this along further. And then the dean has committed to seeking support from the university as a whole for a permanent faculty position at the Humphrey Institute who could provide public policy advice. But the other interesting thing is Mr. Wahlstrom is one of the strongest advocates for using systems dynamic modeling as a tool, and he got that in the private sector. And so if we develop this capacity here, it's not just for public policy analysis. It can be helpful to businesses as well as they look at how to better make decisions about issues that they face in strategic contexts. So we see this as an opportunity to make this expertise available across a range of potential customers in Minnesota. At some point we may be asking the legislature for more support for it, but I understand this year is not the year to do that. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members, for your attention. I know you've been hearing a lot about this.
Thank you so much. Mr. Wallstrom.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this concludes our presentation. All I want to do now is just simply open it up for questions. If anybody has any questions you'd like to ask before we start to lose our experts.
Okay. You wouldn't want that to happen now, would we?
No.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. I think for committee members, next Wednesday we're going to hear several of the bills related to economic development and how we might be able to help these folks. But do members have any questions of Mr. Wallstrom or his witnesses?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested, and actually it's probably for Senator Kelly, as to when, if we're going to be invited to this workshop. This stuff is fascinating, and I've not ever been exposed to it, so.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, we'll extend the invitation broadly, and we've had some House staff attend the previous interest group meetings.
I saw them listed up there. Yeah.
And and it was in conversation with Mr. McCormick that we talked about this idea of doing a one-day thing where you'd combine both the concepts. And when Ms. Munson talked about, and you saw the computerized example mm-hmm. of the model, there are some relatively inexpensive beginning tools that we could acquaint you and staff members with to try to – I've tried to experiment with it, but I needed the tutorial, so I didn't get very far. But it's certainly available.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just say I think it would be really important to have understanding and therefore buy-in by members because it is fascinating stuff. I like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Wallstrom.
Can I comment on one thing real quick? I wanted to add to Senator Scheid's answer, and then the reason we used it in the private sector was when you got people into the room and you couldn't agree on anything, it forced you to get data out and put data on the table, and it forced you to look at a model of it, and it depersonalized it. It became less of a person against person and more of a let's talk about the model and the data that backs it up. And it allowed us to take stalemates that we couldn't where we couldn't get over an issue and make a decision and get to the point of making a decision. And that's why we used it.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson?
Mr. Wallstrom and Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the unconstrained base case assumptions, and I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around the the unconstrainedness of it, but then we go through and make a lot of constraints about the growths of energy, things like that. And then also you have your charts that have the national projections of fuel consumption. And, of course, all I can think of is constraints. Mm-hmm. And what I'm thinking is, for instance, planet constraints. Mm-hmm. Do you overlay the planet constraints? For instance, there should be a chart like this for China and India also, and when you overlay that on top of this, it suddenly makes it a completely different conclusion.
Yeah.
Mr. Wallstrom?
Thank you. Our model is not, at this stage of the game, is not an international model. It's focused on more locally. Now, we are partnering. We have plans, and it's not announced. I guess I'm announcing it now, I guess, but we're in negotiations with the Great Plains Institute to take it to the Midwestern region and start to expand it to the 12-state region. And at some point in our discussions with Sandy, we'd like to take it national. But for right now, it's more Minnesota-based. So the question you're asking is not something that we could model today. Mm-hmm. It's never been modeled.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of constraints and how to deal with them, like in this one I put up, as you run into those constraints or those things that you look at and say it's unreasonable, it can't happen. You can't have that many babies, raise them, and educate them in that time frame to meet the growth rate. So we have to look at other solutions. So the value, and I want to make this point really clear, the model is only a tool. 99% of the value comes from the dialogue and the discussion that goes with trying to figure out solutions to solve a problem like what's on the graph right now, which is transportation jobs. The same would be true with the nature of the questions that you're asking. It's getting the right people in the room, digging out what data does exist, and having an intellectual discussion around it and making a decision on how to deal with a constraint. Because you're right, you're absolutely right, Senator, that it's all about constraints and removal of constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Wallstrom. I appreciate you staying on time, and you gave us a lot of information. It'll be very helpful as we go forward. So thank you for that, and to all your witnesses as well.
And thank you for the opportunity to present. We're very appreciative of the support that you've given us in the past. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's do the Austin show.
Hmm?
Let's do the Austin show.
Yeah. And at this time, I would ask the next folks to come on up. This fall, Senator Metzen and Representative Mahoney held some joint hearings, and we traveled to southern Minnesota. We visited Rochester and Austin and looked at some of the partnerships that are happening down there between 3M, the Mayo Clinic, and the University of Hormel Institute in Austin, Minnesota. And I know that we're all very busy, and some members were able to attend, but not everyone. So today we were fortunate enough to have them come up here. They have a wonderful story to tell, and so we'll let them kind of get set up and turn it over to you folks.
When can I pass this out?
We'll get a page for you. Ms. Dennison, you get set up, and whenever you're ready, I'll kind of turn it over to you, and then you can introduce the people that you have along with you today.
Excellent. Okay. And does the page work the DVD for us? We'll take all the technical help
sure,
we
sure.
can get.
Sure, sure. Yep. And Brian's there, I think, to help, too. So between the two, we'll get it.
Okay. Okay, I think. Mm-hmm.
Got you.
Good afternoon, Senator Sparks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Gary. I'm the Executive Director of the Development Corporation of Austin. The Development Corporation of Austin has served the City of Austin and Moore County as its economic development agency for 20 years, particularly focusing on industrial and commercial development. Thank you very much for hearing about our project today, about the International Center of Research Technology. I'll speak a little bit further about the economic impact of our project in a moment. First, I would like to introduce Gail Dennison of the Hormel Institute, who will outline the project.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sparks, for having us here today, and members of the committee. I wish there were more of you here, but perhaps you can spread the word to others. I don't think many of you have been to the Hormel Institute, but we're certainly on the map globally in terms of the world of cancer research. We are part of the University of Minnesota. We're located in Austin, and we're currently undergoing a project that is tripling the size of the existing Hormel Institute. We passed out a little sample of something. You may not have heard of the Hormel Institute, but I bet you've heard of omega-3. It's on everything, including dog food now these days. This is just one of the many discoveries that were found and named in Austin, Minnesota at the Hormel Institute. What we present before you today is an update on our expansion project and also a request for your support for our next phase of development, which is called the International Center of Research Technology. Before we get into that, I want to show a very short DVD that tells about the cancer research of the Hormel Institute. Before I do that, I want to give you a little context about the success of the Hormel Institute. In the scheme of things, you're not a world-class cutting-edge cancer research center or medical research center unless you've achieved a couple of things. One is the ability to win grant funding. In this day and age, with the war in Iraq and the current country's financing, medical research funding has drastically been cut. It's more and more competitive to win those grants. In this same time frame, the awards and grants given to the Hormel Institute have skyrocketed. Week before last, Dr. Dong, our executive director, got yet another $1.6 million grant for cancer research. To give you an idea of where we stand in the context of the University of Minnesota, we have seven section leaders. We have about 100 researchers and employees at the Hormel Institute, but seven section leaders. We did kind of a blanket comparison. How do we compete with the University of Minnesota Twin Cities? And so we did kind of a blind test. We have seven. We did this blind test against 42 of their comparable researchers. Our seven section leaders were awarded more grants than all 42 of their counterparts at University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And that is not to say anything against the campus there, because we're part of that. It's to give you an idea of how high-achieving these scientists are. The other indicator of a world-class research center is its publishing record, where they get published and how often. The Hormel Institute is consistently published in top-tier scientific journals such as Nature, that in all, again, the whole University of Minnesota, you only get published, you know, once or twice a year in those, and the Hormel Institute is annually published in these journals. Again, it says they're world-class and cutting-edge and leaders in cancer research. So I'm going to have the our short DVD played, and I'm only going to play part of this because I want to move it along and really get to the part of what we're here to talk to you about, which is our next development, which is combining research and technology, which will be a one-of-a-kind in our state and our region. I probably have to put the volume up. Okay. All right. Thank you. Oh, wait. Did she push play? There we go.
It's not uncommon for great strides in the advancement of medicine to be achieved through unusual associations and extraordinary circumstances. So it is with the Hormel Institute, one of the nation's foremost medical research laboratories. Established to benefit humanity through medical science research, the Hormel Institute was founded in 1942 by J.C. Hormel and given to the University of Minnesota.
J. Hormel was a visionary. Not only was he a good marketer, but he was an identification of the essential things that are there for a good life. He was the one who thought up the idea of having the institute, and he had the stables out there that were not being used for horses anymore, so he built the first institute in the stables.
Jay actually founded the institute because he wanted to have a research institute in his hometown. So in 1942, he got together here with some of the University of Minnesota faculty, dean of the graduate school, and signed an agreement to establish the institute.
In 1960, we built the present building, which is no longer adequate, nor is it capable of housing and accommodating all the people who will be coming to Austin.
Located in Austin, Minnesota, the Hormel Institute is famous as a world leader in the biological sciences with specialized applications in medicine and agriculture. Historically, the Institute is responsible for significant breakthroughs in the studies of lipid metabolism and chemistry. Today, the Hormel Institute is exploring vital new research in chemo prevention, studying the use of chemical agents, drugs, or food supplements in the prevention of disease. The Institute maintains an intense focus on cancer research. Cancer has now become the number one killer of Americans under age 80, surpassing heart disease. The Hormel Institute is a leader in the study of dietary factors affecting the growth of cancer cells, and in the search for scientifically proven nutritional agents that will guide in the development of preventive means and cures for this devastating illness.
The science we are doing in the Hormel Institute is really first class. The director of the National Cancer Institute have set up a goal for this nation to eliminate the suffering and deaths due to cancer by 2015.
If you get cancer, it's many times not the cancer that will kill you. It is the chemotherapy and the toxicity of that. And so one of our goals is to develop non-toxic dietary agents that can be used for prevention or treatment of cancer.
The focus of my group is on cancer prevention by selenium, which is a trace element nutrient, and also herbal medicine. So we focus on prostate cancer prevention and breast cancer prevention.
The Hormel Institute is engaged in cutting-edge, world-recognized research. Currently, 95% of the Institute's funding comes from federal grants, industrial contracts, and from private foundations such as the Hormel Foundation. During the past year, 30% of the grant applications submitted by the Institute were funded, compared to a national average of only 5%. In spite of the trend where national medical research funding is decreasing, in just 5 years, the Hormel Institute has tripled grants from the National Institutes of Health and doubled its staff. Proof that the Institute succeeds in an extremely competitive environment.
In the past few years, we actually isolated a few chemicals from these food and vegetables. That's including chemicals from ginger, chemicals from green tea.
One of our most promising dietary factors is a compound that's been isolated from ginger called 6-gingerol. And this compound has been shown to be very effective in preventing and treating skin cancers that are induced by sunlight, which is very, very common.
There's two different areas that we're studying. One is the effect of obesity on cancer development, and the other is the effect of food restriction on cancer prevention.
The Hormel Institute is in close partnership with the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and other influential research authorities around the world, engaged in groundbreaking work in the war against cancer and other deadly health threats. In 2006, the Institute broke ground on a new world-class science research facility designed to equip the Institute for continuing excellence in current and future medical research efforts.
I could not be more grateful.
Oh, you can play this just for one more. Yep.
Proud of Thank the you. Institute as governor.
governor of this state.
Thanks.
I know previous governors have
Sorry.
Gone the same way. But this is a marquee institute, and we're very proud of the work that you do. And so to have a difference maker, a game changer, a institute of this kind of magnetic quality that says to the marketplace, come here as a world-class researcher, a world-class scientist, bring your family, raise a family, research, study.
We think this institute, the Hormel Institute, with its proud history of accomplishment, is well-aligned, well-integrated with this long-term vision for the universities in our state's future. It represents academic leadership in one of the most important fields of study today, that is research into the prevention and treatment of cancer. These happen to be the top priorities of the Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, and they clearly are among the very most important priorities for our state.
Well, buildings are tools that we really put in the hands of those who are making these types of dreams and visions of our leadership become a reality. I can guarantee you that Mayo Clinic is very excited about continuing to participate in these kind of collaborations. I personally look forward today and tomorrow to fostering, engendering, and continuing the kind of work that I think we're seeing here right now.
Take a look at the new expansion that's going to be happening at Hormel, at the Hormel Institute. And as you look at it, think of the new people, the new jobs, new homes, new discoveries, all that will be happening here in Austin, Minnesota, because of the growth and what is happening at our institute.
The expansion will add new...
All right. In the interest of time, I'll cut that DVD off there. What you see up here on the screen is what is nearly done being built in Austin, Minnesota. We've built an entire new building thanks to the support of the Hormel Foundation, Hormel Foods Company, the Austin area citizens. And we thought that the building would be done before we started our next development, but because of the word leadership, that is not the case. We're already branching off into a new development, and that is what we are calling, and this may change, but it is called currently the International Center of Research Technology. What this vision of the Hormel Institute and also working with the Development Corporation of Austin is a research technology center that provides our scientists and students and businesses in the area, in the state, in the region, with the most cutting-edge technology available today. We have already committed to developing this International Center of Research Technology by our purchase of the IBM's BlueJeans supercomputer. This is the world's fastest computer. And what this means is that we will be working with IBM in creating the most advanced technology that is available in working in medical research that's available in the world today. The ICRT will work with manufacturers of technology, such as I just mentioned, IBM Rochester, to discover what works to advance cancer research and what tools are out there that we can provide to our scientists. These technologies will support a whole variety of applications, and John will get into that when we talk about the economic development side of the ICRT. But back to how it affects cancer, I think all of us agree we want an answer to cancer as quickly as possible. To give you an idea of how this one tool will work, and we've got a whole range of tools that we plan to provide in this International Center of Research Technology. The BlueJeans alone, it will take what can take years of applying research to different proteins, for example, and condense that to just a couple of days. The computer does that work for us, rather than scientists having to systematically apply compounds to different proteins. Does this work? Does this chemical work? They used to have to do this all manually, and instead, the BlueJeans supercomputer will do that work for us. We announced this with IBM about 2 weeks ago. Senator Sparks, thank you for being there to announce that exciting news. We got statewide coverage. St. Paul Pioneer Press, the Star Tribune, WCCO, because the Hormel Institute was the first in the state to make this commitment to the highest technology, providing it directly to our scientists. And that, again, shows a mark of leadership. And our vision is to continue that. To give you an idea of how this looks in terms of computer modeling, a protein, the wave of the future in cancer research is to identify what is in cancer that is not in other cells. There are proteins that we are identifying just in cancer. And then they can apply a compound that is an inhibitor to cancer. And that's where you see this little box there. They will have the protein just found in cancer, apply an inhibitor. Will this work? And instead of it taking 10 years to develop a drug, it will happen in a lot faster. I was in a meeting with Dr. Dong, our executive director, who's one of the leading cancer researchers in the world. We're very fortunate to have him, not only at the Hormel Institute, but in Minnesota. He announced this plan of what he plans to do with this International Center of Research Technology at a conference in Greece and received a standing ovation from researchers around the world because the answer to this cancer problem is technology and knowing how to apply it to cancer research. This shows you a little bit about in terms of the drug development that they will target certain proteins, and instead of having to take chemotherapy as a response to cancer, they can target just those proteins. That means that you can remain healthy and fight cancer at the same time. Again, these are some of the computer modeling. I won't go into all of this, first of all, because I can't. I don't have Dr. Dong and Dr. Bode with me. The whole point is that the wave of how to respond to cancer is through technology. And we don't want our scientists to have to wait. In line at IBM, they have a blue gene that we can get and have been using hours on their blue gene. For these other pieces of equipment, the protein crystallography, the mass spectroscopy, our scientists in the state have to travel. The protein crystallography, it's only available in Chicago. Our scientists have to travel to this regional center, stand in line, travel with it, and why not accelerate this research right here in Minnesota? And so our plan is definitely to provide that to our scientists directly. And not just our scientists, although to answer cancer research, that alone is important, but what John will get into is the important we're planning to open the doors and allow other scientists in the region, Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota Twin Cities, MinSCU schools, our bio businesses that are attracted to this center. Having this all housed under one roof will be a huge draw to the best scientists in the country and additionally, to scientists from our region. And so are there any questions really about this idea of the center so far? All right, I'm going to turn it over to John then.
Mm-hmm. To put this in the framework of the presentation you just heard and also in the context of job development, we've had conversations with the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota recently, and Mr. Wallstrom is very helpful to help us understand the framework that he and the state of Minnesota are developing. This is a slide that Mr. Wallstrom showed you very recently, and the Institute and the International Center of Research Technology fits in the enabling knowledge clusters in the boxes of catalysis and synthesis, bioinformatics and systems biology, genomics, that next word is proteomics, and high throughput biology. We feel that as the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota and the state begin creating the roadmap for biobusiness economic development, that the Institute is perfectly positioned to serve, in the terminology of the framework, a node to serve various hubs throughout the state of Minnesota. Again, the initial setup cost is $5 million. We will also be seeking $5 million from the federal government. The federal government request will involve site preparation for the equipment, the scientists and research technicians who will operate the equipment, and the software required for the equipment. Here again are the three pieces of the proposal. In terms of jobs, the Institute, in the context of Austin, Minnesota, and Mora County, has become a diamond. We have over 100 new scientists coming to the Austin, a town of 23,000. I've read studies that biobusiness jobs, the average, and this is, I think, 4 years ago, are well into the $60,000 to $70,000 as an average income. They're highly technical, highly educated, highly paid positions. So in this proposal, we have research jobs that are already arriving in southeastern Minnesota. This is without Blue Gene. This is without these pieces of equipment. You put the know-how and the knowledge in that institute with these pieces of equipment, and we are very confident that the astounding success that these researchers have experienced will continue. Also, with working with the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota and other surrounding communities, our partners, we will continue, hopefully, to have increased commercialization of this knowledge. An example of that historically is omega-3, which you've heard about and seen. In the context of omega-3, when it was researched and named at the Hormel Institute, if we had the framework and the understanding of biobusiness that we have today, we certainly would have a omega-3 manufacturing and packaging in this state. Another example that is in the pipeline now from discovery and understanding to commercialization is hopefully gingerol. I'm not an expert in gingerol, but my understanding is it has been identified as it's an active constituent of fresh ginger, but also has preventative characteristics, and is being currently grown by SROC at the University of Minnesota Waseca. It's hopeful that this will be commercialized, developed in Minnesota, hopefully the next omega-3 type of discovery. Along with that is the economic impact of having a globally recognized Center for Research Technology. We expect that with these pieces of equipment, that scientists from around the world will be coming to southeastern Minnesota, again, because of our partners with Mayo Clinic and the entire system of the University of Minnesota. We will become a magnet for scientists. Additionally, and back in relation to the biobusiness framework that the BioBusiness Alliance is putting together, the Institute has expertise in food and life science, bioinformatics, synthesis, and catalysis. Blue Gene has been used worldwide in material science, molecular dynamics, fluid dynamics, physics. It applies very, very well to all industries within the commercialized aspects, the commercialized industries of biobusiness. Again, this equipment will be made available to businesses and institutions and organizations in Minnesota. At this time, I'd like to introduce Malin Schneider. Malin is the retired vice president and general counsel of Hormel Foods Corporation. He's here today representing the Hormel Foundation, of which he is a member.
Mr. Schneider, welcome to the community. Thank you very much, Senator Sparks. It's good to see you again, a familiar face in St. Paul. Last time we met was at the Institute at the unveiling of the Blue Gene from IBM. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am a director of the Hormel Foundation, which was established in 1941, literally on the eve of America's entry into World War II. The founder of the company, George Hormel, and his son, Jay, and a third resident of Austin, established the foundation with two express purposes. One was to benefit the area of Greater Austin and Maurer County, and two, to keep the company independent. The company, Hormel Foods Corporation, has no connection with the Hormel Foundation. However, the Hormel Foundation owns 47 or controls approximately 47% of the stock of the Hormel Foods Corporation, thereby fulfilling what we hope is a successful effort to keep the company independent, particularly important in this day and age with all the mergers and acquisitions going on in the face of so much cheap money. In accordance with the charter of the foundation, it distributes grants to tax-exempt charities. Currently, we have nine qualified organizations as part of the foundation, each of whom organization appoints a director to the foundation. In addition, there are eight elected directors. I am one of the eight elected directors. The money is distributed from the foundation each year to the nine qualified agencies, of which the Hormel Institute is one. And by far and away, from its inception in 1941 and 1942 when the Institute was created, the Institute has been the principal recipient of grants from the Hormel Foundation. In fact, currently it receives over 50% of all the monies available on an ongoing basis each year granted from the nine agencies. So, for example, the Institute receives over 50%. That means that the other eight agencies receive less than 50%. And these monies are used by the Institute for operating revenues. The next point that I would make is that the foundation became excited about the opportunity that the Institute provided. And you have heard earlier from Ms. Dennison and from the video presentation just exactly what's going on at the Institute, and it's an exciting story indeed. I know that initially they focused on foods that you and I eat and the extent to which we could develop cancer cure and cancer prevention. The foods included ginger and green tea and other what I considered more exotic foods, and I asked Dr. Dong, why not focus on something like Boston cream pie and vanilla ice cream? He assured me that was a long way off. In any event, so excited was our chairman, Dick Knowlton, about this project and the success that the Institute had shown, that he initially pledged $10 million from the foundation for the construction and furnishing of this project. Subsequently, we have raised this commitment, this pledge, from 10 to $13.3 million. The company, Hormel Foods Corporation, has pledged $5 million. And in addition, given the support that this has generated within the greater Austin community, we have raised over $1.5 million from the citizenry and small businesses of Austin and the Austin area. Initially, we had set a target of $1 million, and so excited was the community that, in fact, we've raised pledges of $1.5 million. Now, to finance these pledges, the city has agreed to contribute $10 million, and the county has come up with $5 million. So it's a great tribute to the success of the project so far and the anticipated success that this project is going to have in the future that we've had all these entities, private and public, participate. And so to here today, we are asking for the state support in a project that, from our point of view, is well on the way to success. As we look at it from the point of view of the foundation, this is a win-win situation. First of all, we're creating jobs in rural Minnesota. so important to all of us as we think about where migration of populations are going to the central cities. The second point is the kind of jobs that we're talking about. These are not minimum wage or minimum wage plus kinds of jobs. These are jobs that are every community would give their right arm to have. The third point is that it creates for Austin the opportunity of a second major employer. Think, for example, what IBM did for Rochester when it came in 1956, and not only the success that IBM enjoyed, but all the satellite industries that it spawned as a result of its technology. The other point, and the final point I would make, is that it offers an opportunity to create a world-class medical research center in rural Minnesota, and from our perspective, Austin, Minnesota. And as an example of this, Ms. Dennison failed to mention this, I think, more out of modesty than anything else, but Austin is going to chair a worldwide a symposium in October and on cancer, and the choice was between Beijing, China, and Austin, Minnesota, believe it or not. And so to me, that's an indication of not only the success that the Institute has had, but clearly the belief that the international science community, the citizenry of Austin and Maurer County and Minnesota generally has in the success that will succeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Very good testimony.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sparks, at this time I would like to introduce Bonnie Reitz, former mayor of Austin, representing the community of Austin.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee.
Senator Sparks,
nice to see
members
you.
Of the committee. Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our presentation. You can see from the presentation and things that you've already heard that our buttons are just bursting with what's happening here. We're so proud of the Hormel Institute. And it's amazing the economic input and benefit it is to our community. The project that we're doing now is $23.4 million added to our economy and over 100 new jobs. It's just amazing. And it was very exciting when we went to the community and were asking for support for the project. As you heard from Mr. Schneider, we were hoping to get $1 million. And because of the support of over 1,000 individuals and businesses, over $1.5 million came from the community for the project. So it really shows the support there, too. We've used so far private donations and local donations, community sources. Now we're looking to the state of Minnesota to further develop our project. And also we need support from the state of Minnesota to receive the federal funds that we're also looking for. The International Center of Research Technology will not only accelerate cancer research, as you heard, but will provide benefits for bioscience and biobusiness in Minnesota. This project will benefit not only Austin, southeastern Minnesota, but the state of Minnesota and beyond. And if you've not been down to the Institute, we would like today to give you an official invitation. We'll treat you to Spam Burgers and give you a wonderful tour of our Institute. So we thank you very much for your taking the time to listen to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Is that the only choice of meat? If we...
let me see. What do you like, Hormel Cure 81 ham? How would
we
that
try
be?
That.
Okay.
I like
spam. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
If this event was to be held in Beijing, we were going to invite the full committee to go over.
There you go. That's where the next one probably will be.
We'll go to both then. We'll...
Okay. Ms. Dennison?
Senator Sparks, that concludes our presentation. We are very grateful for the opportunity to present it here today to the members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, we are be happy to answer any questions you might have if time allows, as time allows.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Members, do you have any questions? No. Senator Day.
Chairman, I don't have any questions, but
I'm very, very impressed. And well, I've always been impressed with Hormel because I worked for IBM for like 27 years. They fed my family all those years. But outside of that, I just I think it's just great. And I also like the idea that you're actually out into a rural community in the state. And I really – that does have a flavor that's a little different. Yeah. But good luck, and hopefully we all can help as much as we can.
Yeah. May I respond
to
that? You know, we had space for two section leaders when we started the expansion project. And so we put it on our University of Minnesota website to put out to the world, do you want to come to Austin, Minnesota and join our institute? We had over 200 applications of Ivy League trained scientists from around the world that responded. Of those 200, 70 were just stellar, and we again had space to hire two. And so there is no problem with the issue of do they want to move to Austin, Minnesota, because it's lovely for them. We kind of joke because there's not a lot of distractions. They can really focus on their research, and maybe that's what has led to such success. But they hear University of Minnesota, and they hear Mayo Clinic. Now they will hear IBM's BlueJeans supercomputer and these other pieces of equipment that we plan to provide for them. And so, really, there's no issue with whether it's rural or not. Our world has changed a lot so that the location is not as important as, you know, what you're providing. Again, our connections and collaborations with Mayo Clinic and IBM, those are as equal from them coming to us as we're excited about them. So it's really great.
It is a very exciting story, and I think that's something we should be very proud of. Can you just touch real briefly, I know we have to get out of here at 3 o'clock, another committee is coming in, but can you talk a little bit about the initiatives, too, that with the University of Minnesota and the Austin Public Schools with some of the things that are going on there with the science?
Yep, absolutely. The Hormel Foundation, as part of the expansion or kind of a tangent off of the expansion of the Hormel Institute, we were going to bring 100 new scientists to Austin, Minnesota. Now, these scientists that are coming from all parts of the globe don't really care if there are really nice restaurants or, you know, maybe what the architecture looks like. One thing they do care about are what is the school system and what is the level of education for our children? Because generally what happens is you have brilliant PhD scientists, parents, their children are as bright as their parents are. So they care about education. The Hormel Foundation, to kind of help with the community, because they support Austin Public Schools anyway, but in light of this expansion, donated $3 million to Austin Public Schools to improve the school district. The program that the schools came up with is we will improve our science lab. So that is one part of the expenditure of the $3 million. The other is a first of a kind in the country. They are providing a free master's program to any teacher that is interested. So we have 96 of our educators, our teachers in Austin that are going back to college, getting their master's degrees paid for free of charge, thanks to the Hormel Foundation. That's a bellwether, you know, program in the entire country. So we're really excited about that. And that not only improves our current teachers, but it's a draw for who's graduating this year, where do you want to go to teach school. We'll get the best and the brightest coming to Austin because they'll want that paid-for master's program. So we're pretty excited and very thankful to the Hormel Foundation for that.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Senator Shy.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I was one of those people who was lucky enough to visit, I don't know, was it in October that we were there?
Yeah.
It was a really beautiful day, I know. And I was out of the room when you started, so I wondered what the proposal was. Remember, we went there kind of, it was the Capital Investment Committee, but I don't know if there's an actual capital investment request or...
I think it was actually we were a little bit late for the Capital Investment Committee. So when we were there, it was with Senator Metz and then Representative Mahoney's joint committee. So now we're going to move on Wednesday. I think there's about three bills that will possibly help not only the Hormel Institute but also the Biobusiness Alliance.
Well, it wasn't there with the bonding committee.
It wasn't
committee.
The bonding, no.
I'm sorry. Well, so, well, in any case.
We only made 301 stops on the bonding committee, so.
Do you have the blue jean yet, or you've ordered?
We have the blue jean.
You have it.
Okay. We have it. It just, the crates were being unpacked yesterday as I was going through the hallways, and so we have made a commitment to making this happen, you know, one way or another. But again, we really need the state of Minnesota now to step up and, you know, become part of our project. And also federal monies. We did receive a $400,000 grant from Congressman Waltz from his efforts. But, you know, we've used the resources in our community, and yet there's so much success potential, we now need the state to get on board. So we don't know whether it's bonding or you or whomever, but we just are hopeful that somebody here at the state will get on board with us.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but I'm fascinated with this, and I wondered, is the blue jean then available within the university system?
Absolutely,
because it's so
yes.
huge. It
yes,
seems like it.
Yep,
could be
absolutely. That is our commitment to this International Center of Research Technology is to make it available to other entities that are out there. So that means, you know, Mankato, St. Cloud, University of Minnesota, Rochester. Our lead scientists, Dr. Dong and Dr. Bode, are part of creating that program that's a one-of-a-kind in the state, also at University of Minnesota, Rochester, creating these specialized degrees. So, yep, it's open and available, as will the other pieces of equipment and technology.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Scheid,
lastly, I mean, Dr. Dong is a gem.
Yeah.
And I love his personality, and I'm sorry you didn't bring him, and you tell
yes.
him.
Yes, he's actually on a research mission with Dr. Bode, so otherwise he would have been here. And
please tell him we miss
him. He will love hearing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chairman Metzen, anything else for today?
No, I'm just, first of all, I congratulate you on the fine work that you're doing. And I'm just kind of, we have to do a little research in the next few days. At least I have to figure out what pot of money we can seek for this project. And right now I'm not clear on where that's coming from because it's not in a bonding thing. And we got some other initiatives coming next week to this committee with about $30 million, I believe. And what's the acronym for that? Is it
seed
money? And I don't know, but I'm hopeful that we can make some of that, if that's in the global part of the $30 million, some of that available for this cause here. And maybe if not, we can frame the language that comes to this committee next week to make them eligible or get them in on it. Because I'm getting on in age, and if we could find a cure for this stuff... And a couple
Senator
of
Metzen, tell and me about your,
I shouldn't
Dr.
say
Dong
it, but
knows about my situation.
Senator Scheid has had some challenges in this area, so
we thank want, you.
But she's been doing quite well, and we want her around
yes,
too.
I am.
So
thank you.
Get
both.
Going, would you?
Exactly.
But, seriously, you're doing a great job.
Right. And we'll work hard, next
Senator
week.
Sparks,
we
for
we
being a leader
yes.
in this area for your
oh,
not just your community,
absolutely.
But for the state and, quite frankly, for the nation when this stuff starts.
That's right.
So Senator Sparks has been a champion, too.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks for your patience, members. We'll start hearing bills next
this is
week,
good.
So get ready. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
With that, meeting's adjourned.
Awesome.